Hello, everybody, and welcome to the third episode of Retail Ramblings. We're three episodes in now, and we're starting to get excited about where this podcast is going and some of the great themes that we've already touched on. So what we're going to do to begin with is just go through a recap of what we touched on with our last episode. So we had a look at the retail winners and losers, where Behr Paint was featured along with Benefit Cosmetics on the cosmetic sides of things. And Milwaukee Tools and SD Edit were the unlucky losers for the week. On the retail roadmap, we looked at robotics in retail and where that's taking the direction of retail. And for the data dive, we had a look at ColourPop personalizing through Qubit. On today's episode, we're going to be going through the winners and losers again, both on the DIY and cosmetic side. We've got big winners this week. So we've got JAF and Owens Corning. And on the cosmetic side, we've got Decium. For the unlucky losers, I should say, we've got Home Depot and some theft that's happened at Home Depot, and also Avon. So without further ado, we're going to go ahead and look at the retail winners and losers for the week. So let's jump straight into it and the winners for the week. So we're going to start off again in the home improvement industry and look at a winner from the home improvement industry. So our big winners this week are JAF Materials Group and Owens Corning. Now, the reason I've picked them out to be big winners is not something that they've actually done themselves as organizations, but rather on a macro scale, the asphalt roof shingles industry, I should say, and some great news that's come out of that. So a report published by the Fredonia Group has shown that the industry is expected to grow 5.6% until 2021, and it's going to be an $8.5 billion industry. Now, that's pretty crazy, Marsha. I don't know about you, but to think that roof shingles is $8.5 billion. So it's a massive market and a massive opportunity.
Yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that.
Yeah, exactly. It's a product that generally is only used every 20 to 30 years. So roofing doesn't get replaced that often, but when it does, it is quite an expensive product. And there's an enormous opportunity for JAF and Owens Corning to really grab the market. They're the two main competitors within that industry. And on the macro level, there's been a few things that have affected this. So housing starts in the United States, and we've already talked about this in previous episodes. So if you haven't heard them, go back and listen to them. But the housing industry and the residential market in the United States at the moment is booming. Previous booms in 73, 78, 87, 95 have all had really similar characteristics, as well as the subprime mortgage crisis before that. All the building that started in 2003 shared the same amount of housing starts. So it's great news for anybody in home improvement at the moment, because mum and dad, shoppers, contractors, they're all heading to Home Depot, they're all heading to Lowe's, and it's a really big win for any organization that sells through there. Now, the reason asphalt shingles is going to do so well is they're a great product for some really trying conditions that you can find in the United States. So particularly in coastal areas where winds is obviously a big issue and some crazy storms that are along that East Coast, roof shingles and particularly asphalt roof shingles are really great at standing up to the conditions and making sure that, you know, the house is protected and the irrigation is working correctly on roofing. They're also a better alternative to wood. They're a better alternative to any stone or concrete style shingles. So it's a really, really big opportunity for JAF and Owens Corning as well. So, Marsha, I'll let you jump into the loser for the week. Who have we got for the loser on the home improvement side?
So, Chris, I have a very bizarre story for this week, and okay. I just thought it was too entertaining not to share. So we talked about Home Depot in a past episode as a winner in the do-it-yourself space, and they've just been on such a high, and they've been doing amazingly well. But in the recent week, they've had such a bizarre story happen to them. They had somebody who was coming into their barbecue department, and they were taking the price tags off of a $1,600 barbecue and swapping it with the price tag of a $200 grill. So with that, they would go ahead and they would purchase these grills. And on top of that, they would be using fake Home Depot gift cards.
That's brilliant.
So it is pretty brilliant if you think about it, but not so brilliant for the Home Depot. So finally, this person was caught. It looks like there was a second person involved, and the they're caught with doing this 18 times. So I think it just goes to show that, you know, even a giant like Home Depot, somebody that's doing so well in the retail industry, they're not immune to this, and they need to look at how to step up their security measures so this doesn't happen again.
It's a funny one, Marcia. So who's the loser on this one? Is it Home Depot or the guy who was selling the barbecues online?
I think it's a little bit of both, I would say. Home Depot probably not getting the best press from something like that. And just in general, if you take a look at their grilling department and compare it to some other retailers, particularly retailers that specialize particularly in barbecuing, you would see that Home Depot isn't doing too great there. So lots of room for improvement in that department and also on their security measures.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. We've discussed it in the past, and Home Depot is tremendously successful with the contractor market. And maybe the grills, I can't imagine there's a lot of contractors going in there and buying grills. They're looking for tools, they're looking for materials to be able to complete the jobs that they've been contracted to do. But do you think that's a large reason why that department hasn't been as successful for Home Depot?
I think so. I mean, you know what it is. I think they really do need to focus on what they're best at. And I wouldn't say that grills really fall into that category. So maybe that space could be used for something better in the Home Depot.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that again, because anecdotally speaking, I was at Home Depot not too long ago, and as obviously the summer's starting to arrive here in North America, I was looking for a grill for my patio, and I did notice that Home Depot's selection was really, really limited. So maybe, you know, it is testament to the different markets they serve. And at the moment, if we put this in conjunction with the housing boom that's going on in the United States, it's probably an area that they're better off just ignoring, isn't it?
Potentially, yeah. I really do think they need to take a better look at it and make some hard decisions.
Yeah, perfect. That's a great one, Marcia. So we're going to jump over to the cosmetics side and look at some of the cosmetics winners that we have for this episode. So, well, I should say our only one winner is DCM skincare products. Now, DCM's a really, really interesting brand, and recently they've just been invested in by Estee Lauder. Now, I want to talk about the brand a little bit first, because I think some of the themes that come out of this are really important. DCM's a Toronto-based skincare brand that started in 2013, and they're really unique in the sense that they're actually a vertically integrated company. So what that means is they're responsible for their own research, their own manufacturing, their own e-commerce, their own retail, which is really, really interesting, and their own marketing. Now, it allows them to move quickly, it allows them to innovate quickly, and it allows them to respond to the market really, really quickly. Now, the reason that I've pointed them out from a theme perspective is they kind of remind me almost of a mini Sephora, right, Marcia? So
yeah.
What it is they have 10 brands, and when they were founded in 2013, they didn't concentrate on one brand or one particular product. Their CEO and co-founders went out and said, we're going to create 10 brands and we're going to retail them through our own stores. So they've basically done what LVMH did with Sephora, but did it on a tiny scale. And it's allowed them to be extremely nimble, allowed them to target their market really effectively, and allowed them to be extremely successful. I was reading a statistic that one of their brands, Grow Gorgeous, grew 700% year on year before it was sold last year. So these are massive increases, and it gives them the power to retail their brand how they want to retail it. It gives them the brand to the power, pardon me, to advertise that they want to advertise, and it gives them the ability to really tap into the market that they're going for, which is millennials. Now, the reason I couldn't quite decide whether Estee Lauder was the winner or DCM was the winner. DCM's obviously a big winner because they're getting a cash injection. Okay,
absolutely, so yeah.
It's going to give them the ability to strengthen, to be more competitive in the marketplace. And if you look at some other recent acquisitions of indie cosmetic brands by Estee Lauder, they've been tremendously successful. So I'm talking about your Too Faced, your Becca's, your Glam Glows that have all been tremendously successful since Estee Lauder's invested in them. But on the other side of the coin, it's a really big win for Estee Lauder because it gives them, we discussed in our last episode, and if you haven't gone and listened to it already, I strongly recommend you do, because Estee Edit was their attempt to target the millennial market. And by discontinuing Estee Edit and going across to DCM, they've made a really great move in being able to tap in and reach millennials again and not completely ignore that market. It just allows them to diversify who they're targeting and what exactly that they're doing. It also gives them the ability to leverage the research that's coming from DCM and their retail stores. Obviously, Sephora is the heads and above leader in that space there, but it does give them the ability to really leverage the research there.
That's really interesting, Chris. I love this example. Have you checked out their presence on YouTube? Do you see that as contributing to their success as well? Or are they getting some good reviews from influencers in the beauty space?
To be honest, I actually haven't been too much on their YouTube, but what I did notice is that they have a really large Instagram post about this acquisition by Estee Lauder. So on that Instagram post, the comments are mixed. I think a lot of them, animal testing is a big one in the cosmetic space, right? As I'm sure you know, and a lot of people are critical of Estee Lauder and their track record with animal testing. And there have been comments that have said, although DCM don't animal test, the fact that they've aligned themselves and been acquired, or they haven't been acquired, they've been invested in by Estee Lauder, basically aligns and condones that sort of behavior. So the comments on social have been mixed, and the millennial market is the one that's really on there, and they're the ones who are going to feel it the most.
That's really interesting. I'm curious to see how this situation evolves and if they'll remain a winner.
Yeah.
I have a good feeling. Looks like they're doing well.
I'm excited too. So who have we got for the loser this week, Marsha?
So for the loser this week, I'm going to be profiling Avon. So Avon, as you all know, is a line of natural beauty products, and they carry things like all the way from shampoo to foundation to lipsticks and everything in between. And you're probably most familiar with the brand as they target a lot of stay-at-home moms to kind of go around and sell their products and to do beauty parties and to distribute the products in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been around for years now, and they've been doing really well, but it seems like they've been struggling.
Sorry, Marsha, this is like Avon parties, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. So a piece of news that surfaced this week is that Avon's CEO, Sherry McCoy, is expected to step down. And, you know, she's been in the trenches for a while and really putting in a lot of efforts to turn around the struggling cosmetics brand, but just hasn't been having a lot of luck. So she was able to raise their stock 1.45% since 2012. But in the last few years, it's really dropped. So that's something that's going on. But also, to make matters worse, their latest new hire, Tom Canopy, who joined the company as CIO from Staples in September, has actually just recently quit as well, only 6 weeks into the role.
God.
So that's not very promising as well. I'm really wondering what the reasons for that were.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think their retailing method is a really interesting thing to think about from this. Avon obviously was successful going straight to consumers and going straight to houses and holding and using influencers. And I guess they were the pioneers of influencer marketing, weren't they?
Absolutely. They were in there before social media was even a thing. So they were going live to the influencers right in their homes.
Yeah. Where do you think that stands? Do you think that type of marketing has just evolved for brands, or do you think that there is still a place for, you know, Tupperware was the other one, Tupperware parties. Is there still a place for that type of retailing?
To be honest, I think we've evolved a little bit past that. I think, you know, with the rise of online shopping and the types, like with retailers like Sephora out there, I just think there's much better and more exciting ways to shop for your makeup needs.
Yeah, to be honest, I probably agree.
Yeah. Okay, so next up, we're going to be going into the retail roadmap section of our podcast. And here we're going to be focusing on an area of where retail is moving in the future. So today I want to talk about the use of virtual reality in retail. So VR is a term that we've been hearing a lot in general. So there's virtual reality games, there's simulations, there's all kinds of exciting applications. But what I'm most excited about being in retail is seeing how it's making its way to retail and some of the really cool applications where it's being used. So an example that I came across this week was L'Oreal, and they're using virtual reality to make internal decisions at its New York head office. So for those of you that don't know, L'Oreal is based in Manhattan, and they have a huge, beautiful office there. And what they introduced there recently is a virtual reality room. If you take a look at our show notes, you can see some pictures of it. Wow. And it just looks super cool and really futuristic. And what they're using it for is to let their all of their brands, over 30 different brands that they have, use the technology to test product packaging and to be able to make branding decisions faster and more efficiently. So one success story that they've had in the recent weeks was one of their brands, Dermablend, which is a dermatologically created brand of foundations and concealers. So they were actually looking to do some new packaging design and the rebranding for their display unit in Ulta. And they needed to make some decisions fairly quickly. So what they did was they virtually laid all of their options out in this virtual reality room. They brought in a focus group and they had them take a look at the different options that they had for the branding and packaging. And this worked really quickly, and the group was able to get a very realistic look at how exactly this would look on the Ulta shelves. And with this process, it only took them 3 months to do this rebranding for Ulta. And keep in mind that usually a process like this takes anywhere from 8 months to a year. So without this VR demonstration, L'Oreal and this Dermablend unit, they would have lost almost 5 months in sales. So the cost of the VR room was definitely justified there. Something else that's interesting is that the team that coordinates this within L'Oreal is actually called the Future of Retail team. So I was really impressed to see that they have a team that works on this. Retail is moving so quickly. So
I wonder if they've got a podcast.
Yeah.
Maybe
they do. Maybe that's their next project. That's very true, Chris. So they have this amazing team in there, and they're really owning the usage of this room, and they're acting as a cross-divisional partner for the company to show other units how to use it. And there's definitely a learning curve involved when working with this kind of technology. But again, as we saw with the example of the Ulta rebrand, definitely worth it. So really interesting to see where L'Oreal takes this, and I'm sure a lot of other big brands are going to be jumping on board as well using technology like this. Another application of VR in retail that I wanted to talk about was Walmart's use of VR for training. So imagine this scenario. You're a new Walmart store manager and you've never experienced a Black Friday before. So what's the best way for you to train? Is it to kind of dive right in and see if you can swim? Or is it to kind of go into it in a virtual reality world and test out some different situations? Yeah, so they're actually, Walmart is testing this technology as well. And they're allowing their associates to experience a lifelike store environment to experiment, learn, and handle difficult situations without the need to recreate disruptive incidents or disturb the customer's shopping experience. And I thought this was really cool. And some studies already from this show that associates that were going through the VR training were also found to retain what they learned in these situations much better than those that hadn't. And right now, this VR training is being rolled out to all 200 academy facilities by the end of 2017. And it's reaching over close to 150,000 associates who will graduate each year. So
yes.
I think that's super cool.
And it's interesting to note, and I strongly recommend, if you haven't listened back to our last episode, listen to it, because we talked about robotics in retail. And one of the overarching themes about robotics in retail was that wages were going to be, or money was going to be saved from wages that was spent at lower level staff. And it's great that you could see the money going towards something such as virtual reality to train management in a situation such as Black Friday. So
yeah,
it's
absolutely a
really, really exciting time for retail in that sense, that all these different technological advancements aren't necessarily segregated from each other. They're all intertwined and they all affect each other in making us more efficient, more effective, and basically make retail, both bricks and mortar and online, better.
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I noticed, you know, I was reading through some of the comments that were left on this some of these articles about the VR, and you know, some people weren't too happy about it being implemented in Walmart, and they thought that, you know, it doesn't replace the human touch of being trained, similar to the comments that we saw on the robotics.
Mm.
But I think it's just one of those things, you know, some people are hesitant to change and maybe they don't see the benefits of it right away, but I'm a big proponent of this. I think it's going to be a really great way for people to train. And of course, it's a, you know, it's not replacing the in-person training. It's just another way to simulate some situations that you might not be able to train in unless some kind of incident occurs. So I think it's great.
Couldn't agree more, Marsha. So we've gone along and we've had a look at our winners and losers for the week, and we've also had a look at the retail roadmap and explore virtual reality and the repercussions that that's going to have on retail. We're going to take the last few moments to have a data dive. So we're looking at a company that's using data effectively in retail and really utilizing data to be a better organization. Now, the organization, unless you've been sitting under a rock or living under a rock, I should say, is going to be Amazon and their purchase of Whole Foods. Now, it's not how they're using data at the moment, which is we could harp on about for hours with Amazon, but it's rather about the acquisition itself and how data is going to play a massive part in that acquisition. So if you have been living under a rock, Amazon has purchased or bid to purchase all Whole Foods stores in North America, and I think there's 9 in the UK as well. And they're doing this for a multitude of reasons, and reasons that have been suggested is to delve into the grocery market and online groceries, to get a shop front and a physical bricks and mortar retail presence. And a big reason behind that is as much as we do talk about omnichannel and the growth of online sales still is only expected to account for 9.8% of retail sales in the United States by 2019. So to have a bricks and mortar presence is essential still. We're still awaiting online to take over, and that could be 30, 40 years before it's a 50-50 arrangement. Now, one other reason that Amazon potentially has acquired Whole Foods is also to use as a delivery base. There's obviously drones being developed by Amazon that have been in the news recently. So it could also be that Amazon's looking for something as a DC, essentially a distribution center. But one big reason that we like to think is extremely important here, because we have a massive focus on data, is that Amazon has acquired Whole Foods as a means of acquiring customer data. Now, you're probably wondering, how is that? Now, Amazon has over 300 million customers, and they're able to track online behavior, and that's extremely important to see how consumers shop online and what they're doing, their purchasing habits, what people are buying together, what sort of products complement each other. But what Amazon can't see is how people shop in store. And the shopping experience between online and on store are drastically different. People online generally know what they're going to buy, generally don't window shop because there's nowhere really to window shop. They're not inclined to make impulse purchases unless there's extremely strong call to actions and recommendations. So the bricks and mortar retail space contrasts with this significantly. Bricks and mortar is all about somebody going in, and this is how Whole Foods basically made themselves successful, was by having consumers come in store, go in to buy, say, a carton of eggs for $5 and leave spending $150 on organic gummy bears. So that was always their strategy. And the markets that Amazon and Whole Foods both target overlap with each other quite significantly. So Amazon, by acquiring Whole Foods, now has the opportunity to gather all this data and see what type of purchasing decisions people are making in store and what type of heuristics they use in store that lead them to spend $150 over $5. Extrapolate that data and take it online and see exactly how they can make their website and their omnichannel strategy more optimized to try and get people to spend more money. So this is a big win for Amazon, and it's really going to see a drastic shift again in retail in North America, and see the space get even more competitive.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, it's been such an exciting couple of weeks in retail, and I think this Amazon acquisition has everybody really buzzing with excitement and anticipation of what's to come. I think something that's so interesting about this acquisition is that their choice of what it is. You know, Whole Foods, it's not a regular grocery store. You're not going to find big name products like P&G brands in there or anything like that. Really, it's all sort of like craft and emerging brands, really like independent labels that are catering to a really specific niche. And I'm really thinking about the repercussions of this for retail in general. I mean, I think it's a trend that we're seeing even with Sephora, some of the brands that they're bringing on board, they're tiny startup cosmetics brands. But now that they're under this retail giant, they're able to have the opportunity to grow and to get worldwide recognition. Do you think this is going to be the case for some of the brands that are carried by Whole Foods as well?
Yeah, and DCM's a great example of it, right? We spoke about them as a loser, and it's becoming more about, it's no longer brand awareness and brand loyalty trumping everything else in the retail space. It's more so people are willing to experiment, willing to try new brands. And the repercussions for companies such as Amazon and P&G's, they need to augment their offerings and try and segment to a greater degree. And I think that's where Amazon's going to be successful, because Amazon's got all this data to be able to do that now, right? So they're able to create products and bring products out that really, really target people based on skin color, based on ethnicity, based on personal preferences, based on age, based on demographics, and it's only going to get, we're only going to continue to segment to lower and lower numbers, which is really, really exciting. It's going to mean that we're going to get products that are tailored for us, and we're going to get some really excellent products.
Very cool.
So we've come to the end of another episode, another exciting episode of Retail Ramblings. We've gone through today our winners and losers, the retail roadmap and the data dive, with our winners being GAF and Owens Corning on the DIY side, and the loser on the DIY side being Home Depot and their security staff. We've had our winners on our cosmetic side feature DCM, and our losers on the cosmetic side feature Avon, who have run into a few structural changes that have caused them to struggle a little bit lately. With our retail roadmap, we've had a good look at virtual reality and the repercussions that that's going to have on retail. And finally, in the data dive, we've had a look at Amazon and what's the future holds for Amazon with the acquisition of Whole Foods and the repercussions on their ability to accrue data. So we look forward to catching you at the next episode.